We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.
Today's guest is the champion Australian leg spinner, Stuart McGill. Now, I'd probably be happy to devote more of this podcast to cricket, but I've held off because I wanted to speak to a cricketer who thinks a little deeper about life and the world than your average test legend. In cricketing terms, Stuart was an incredibly gifted leg spin bowler who turned the ball a mile and had a brilliant test average, and who just happened to come along at the same time as the greatest leg spinner of all time, Shane Warne. But McGill never tried to compete with Warne. Warne was all bravado and glamour, whereas McGill held his emotions in check. Warne dyed his hair blonde, whereas McGill had a sensible tea towel tucked into his pants with which he'd polished the ball. Warne would saunter back to his mark, grinning and toying with the batsman's mind, whereas McGill would scuttle back, eyebrows furrowed like a mathematician trying to solve a problem, before unleashing another one of his lethal leg breaks. The facts are that he's the 7th quickest in history to get 200 wickets, getting to the milestone faster than both Warne and the all-time greatest wicket-taker, Mathai Muralitharan. Outside of cricket, Stuart's a voracious reader, famously reading 42 novels on a tour of Pakistan. He's politically aware, once boycotting a tour of Zimbabwe because he wasn't comfortable with the Mugabe regime. And in 2000, he married the Australian actress Rachel Friend, and the couple, who separated in 2013, have 2 children together. Since he retired in 2008, he's hosted a TV show about wine and been a coach for hire. He's had a few public ups and downs, but now he's getting back on track, and I encourage you all to follow his witty and polemical Twitter account, at SCGMcGill. Please forgive the sound quality on this interview. The reception wasn't great, but the content is, as usual. I started by asking Stuart when he was most happy.
I was probably at my happiest when I didn't know what was going on around me. So I suggest that it was probably just as I left school.
Yeah.
And look, that's not to say that I haven't been happy since, but I really do think that's the great thing about being a kid. You know, you don't really know what you're in for. So, you know, you still think you're probably pretty good at everything. But nobody's told you that you're not yet. So, probably just as I took my first steps after school.
Did you know that you were going to play international cricket when you were at school? Did you have a pretty good feeling that was the future for you?
No, I like a lot of kids that play cricket. When I was little, in the back garden, it was a dead cert. I was going to play cricket for Australia or the West Indies, you know, because I wanted to be a Harry Quick, you know. I wasn't very good. In year 12, I don't think I was even the first bowler there. But Daniel Marsh, who ended up playing for Tasmania, he was at school about 3 years younger than me, and he was first pick spin bowler in the first 11 at school. And I was sort of nothing really at school in cricket terms. I batted pretty much the same, which wasn't going to get me anywhere. And bowling, you know, was a bit erratic. But it wasn't until I was about 20 that things started to just really click into place. And I thought, hang on a second, I'm a chance here.
Right. Was that when you started bowling leggies, or were you bowling them at school?
No, I bowled leggies. My dad, who played about a dozen shield games for WA, my dad was a leggie, and so I always bowled leggies. And I also bowled quick. I wanted to be a quick bowler, but I bowled quick. I thought I was bowling quick until I was about maybe 15. I did both. And then I realised that I was too short and too uncoordinated to be, you know, considered a quick bowler. So I think what happened was I just kept trying to turn the ball as much as I could, and then when I, you know, was 19, 20, all of a sudden I just started taking wickets. It just it pretty much clicked about, you know, 6 months after I left school.
Wow. Okay. So. Well, there was some. It would have been some happiness around that point for sure.
There was happiness. I mean, around selection time, there was happiness. And also, the other thing that there was, you know, there was a lot of happiness about was when I first got picked. I played one game for Western Australia. I was 12th man a bunch of times. But when I first got into the squad there, I think I was working in a cafe in Northbridge, living week to week from, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And I remember going on a tour to maybe Victoria. I went to the ATM and it's like $4,500 in my bank account. And I remember going, hang on a second, you know, I kind of like this cricket thing. So, I mean, man, like, you know, 45 cents to $4,500. And then all of a sudden I realised why people played sport for a living.
Question two, who would you like to apologise to and why?
I am going around apologising to a lot of people nowadays. the problem, you know, there's a saying, you know, you got to be careful who, you know, how you treat people on the way up.
It's
going to come and bite you when you're on the way down. But I think, I'm not sure if I necessarily deliberately treated people badly when I was, you know, being, well, when I was successful on the cricket field. It's more that, you know, I was really, really busy for a number of years.
Yeah.
I never found cricket very easy. It consumed me pretty much. You do become kind of pretty self-absorbed. I was self-absorbed just to maintain any sort of semblance of consistency. I kind of had to do that, otherwise it was just not going to be, something that I could do. I think it was deliberate too. I mean, I just had to, you know, sort of thought, well, look, if this is going to continue, I've got to be pretty much just into what I'm doing. And if we ever had any time off, that's when I would actually just totally step away from cricket. Because I didn't necessarily like being self-absorbed, but it was just the only way it had to be. So now that I'm not playing cricket anymore, I'm sort of finding myself, you know, I'm rekindling friendships, you know, occasionally. I'm dipping my toe very, very cautiously into the water, but I'm apologising in that sense, I guess, you know, because I don't remember, I don't remember necessarily ignoring people or, you know, walking past people in the street, but, you know, I've become good friends again with a couple of people from school and, you know, I'm enjoying that. So I think the answer to your question in short form is, you know, it's an open apology. To anybody who I walked past in the street and apparently ignored, I'm apologising. I'm sorry. But I played test cricket when you didn't. Yeah.
Well, it's the thing is, you're so visible, and you know, I always liken it to, because I'm a massive cricket fan, for about, it's an ongoing soap opera where the characters are about, there are 17 or 18 characters in the soap opera that will pretty much occupy the Australian consciousness for about 10 years, you know. Cool. And so it's, you've got a lot of people saying hello to you in the street, you know, that's the,
oh, yeah.
That's the payoff.
And in my case, in bars.
Yeah. Yeah. Question three is, what is your greatest regret?
Well, look, there's no doubt that you know, my greatest regret is not being married anymore. I was married for 13 years, and I liked it very much, and I doubt very much that, well, not doubt very much, I can almost guarantee that it won't happen again. And and that's mainly because I do regret not not being married anymore. I loved having a family, and I enjoyed just about every aspect of it. Even the hard bits, I saw that as being just a part of a gig. And I'm very grateful that I have still got a you know, any sort of relationship with my ex-wife, and I'm still really close to my kids, so that's good. We you know, they spend every other week with me, so and they're growing up to be very nice kids. So I'm very pleased about that, but certainly I regret not being in the same house anymore. That's a shame. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe inevitable, because I am who I am, and maybe I wouldn't like to be married to me either. But you know, I regret that I'm not what I could have, should have been. But that.
You would have been quite young when you got married too.
No.
Oh, really?
No, I wasn't.
All right, okay.
No, I was married at 30, and finished around about, you know, early 40s, 43. So, but look, one thing that I do say, and it's not just, you know, stupid sporting cliche, it's, you know, in order to get up every day, you know, I don't spend too much time on the regret side of things, and it was only, you know, it's only really when asked questions, you know, by people like yourself, that I do spend any time thinking about it at all, because it's far easier just to you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself down and move on. If you can get consumed by regret and kind of get stuck, and that's certainly not something that I want.
Does playing sport at the highest level toughen you up emotionally? Does it actually toughen you up for you know, the wins and losses in life?
I think certainly being an international bowler, bowlers and batsmen have very different setups mentally. I think being a bowler, you and being any good at it, I think you become incredibly tough.
Mm.
Because, and I guess being a slow bowler, maybe even more so, because let's face it, anybody can hit me to sticks. You know, you know, your kids, or my mum, you know, anybody can hit me to sticks. It's about how you handle getting hit to sticks, and whether or not you can go back to the top of your mark and go again and go again and go again. And then even to a large degree, when you're successful, how you can go back to the top of your mark. It's about just being able to recreate a moment in time over and over and over, repetition and routines. And I think that those things are they're skills that you can, you know, really benefit from having in the real world. The problem is, of course, that you know, if you're able to do that, then, you know, I don't know, maybe you should dwell on bad times a little bit longer than I do. But you know, I just kind of feel that, you know, because I reckon that was actually one of the reasons why I was, that set me aside from a lot of people who were probably better than me. I was really, really good at, you know, just moving on. You know, I didn't give it a second thought, because my goal was never to my goal was never to get hit for six or to have a bad day. It was always the good stuff, so I just, like, pretend it never happened. I would completely pretend things never happened.
That's yeah,
and I was really good at it.
I know. I just remember watching you. You had that steely look about you. You know, steely look of resolve.
The blue steely.
Yeah.
I think the thing is that look was all about, as I said before, you know, things were very hard. I think you're very exposed, and so I had to do that. Mm. Just like go back and try and recreate that one moment again.
Mm.
And I knew I had a good ball in me. And if I bowled a full toss or a half tracker, it wasn't deliberate. I'd just go back and try and do it again. And I got very good at doing that. And you know, I think I'm pretty positive person as a consequence.
Yeah, yeah. I often think that, well, particularly because I'm in, you know, in the arts and show business, that, you know, a lot of us are snowflakes. We're very sensitive and everything. And I feel, you know, it'd be good to hang out with international sports people occasionally and just learn how to be a bit tougher, you know, how to move on quicker.
That's exactly what it is, mate. It's moving on. It's about moving on and moving on quicker. And I certainly wouldn't call you a snowflake, Adam.
Thanks, mate.
And there's a nice little back catalogue of work there too, so I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Question four is, what will you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
What do I still need to do?
Yeah.
I would like to be good at something again. There is this sense in me that maybe I've done the thing that I would, you know, that I was good at. I would like to find and develop something again, because there is a, you know, it's a bit of a shame to think that, you know, hang on a second, I've peaked. So what I'm trying to do is, and you know, there's certainly no scientific method that I'm using to do this, by the way. But I am trying to find something that I can, you know, become very good at again. That would give me a lot more purpose. And, you know, people talk about family and stuff like that. And, you know, obviously, any relationships that I'm in, I try to make sure I do them, you know, live them as well as I possibly can. And you know, I want to be the best dad I can be and that sort of stuff. But I would like professionally to be good at something, because that'd make me feel very happy, I think. That's pretty much it at the moment. I'm pretty happy otherwise. You know, I watch TV for Australia, so I'm good at that, but I'm not sure if I could make a living out of it.
Is there anything on the horizon? Anything that you're working on?
No, let's not really worry too much about the horizon at this stage.
Okay. Yeah. Well, question five is, who is the person who most influenced you and how?
In a cricketing sense, And I think that's probably the only thing that I can sort of latch on to. My dad and my grandfather played cricket for Western Australia.
Stuart's grandfather was Charlie McGill, an opening batsman and right-arm fast-medium bowler who played six first-class matches for Western Australia between 1939 and 1951. And Stuart's father, Terry McGill, played 12 matches for Western Australia between 1969 and 1973.
My dad, you know, probably influenced me, you know, every day as a young bloke. My grandfather opened the batting and the bowling for Western Australia, and
wow.
he was tough. Like, you know, it's really cool. We've got this book called Chuckers. You know, guys that used to chuck them, and Grandpa's in that, which is awesome. You know, it's sort of like how everybody wants to have some, you know, a convict in their family tree. Well, I've got a chucker in mine. But Grandpa, opened the bat and bowling, he got Bradman out, in a game. Yeah, which is cool. And, the story goes that Bradman, you know, invited him to come to South Australia and play when he was there. And, that's awesome. In the same game, he got Bradman out. He got, you know, 4 for 70 and made 75 opening the batting as well. Which is excellent.
Wow.
When I was 6 or 7, I used to catch the bus into the city and meet him at his work, and then we'd go home to his place after school. My mum and dad were working, and I'd watch Lost in Space with him, and I'd sit with him, and he'd tell me about, you know, I remember that, you know, time really quite well. And I, because even though he was supposed to be this big, scary, tough dude, which undoubtedly he was, he was really gentle and kind and nice to me, and he travelled a lot during his time, and he played all sports, but was, you know, very interested in everything else that was going on around him. And I guess he was probably my number one kind of inspiration for, you know, how I wanted to carry myself. And you know, I've travelled a lot of places that he went to, just because I remember him telling me about them. You know, in particular, he loved Florence, so I'd spent quite a bit of time there when I was younger. Yeah, and you know, for a guy who grew up in, you know, Subiaco in the Depression, you know, he was born in 1916, so yeah, I think there wouldn't have been too many people, you know, in his neighbourhood who enjoyed going to Italy.
No.
and so I thought he was pretty cool. And actually, during my first test match was against Adelaide. Unfortunately, it was against South Africa in Adelaide. Unfortunately, Grandpa was dead by then. But I went for dinner with my parents in Kensington. We picked a, you know, nice restaurant out of a magazine. It was good. And it was called Jarmas, and it turned out to be Bradman's favourite restaurant.
Oh.
And Bradman was sitting in there, and you know, we just sort of sat down and started eating. And my dad said, "Oh, Bradman's over there," and I thought, "Oh, I'll go and say hello." And then I thought, "No, you're too cool. You don't need to do that. You know, just leave him alone. That's fine." And so I was just sitting eating my dinner, and then Bradman gets up and starts walking out of the restaurant. And I'm thinking, "Well, you know, just leave him. He's fine. Don't worry about it." And I thought, "No, you're being an idiot." And I chased him out. And I went, you know, chased him out, and I said, "Oh, you know, hi, Sir Don. It's my name's Stuart McGill. I'm playing my first test match, and you know, I just wanted to say hello." He said, I know who you are, son. Well bowled today." And then he said, "My God, your grandfather could play cricket."
Oh wow!
And that was sort of the thing, you know, because for me, Don Bradman knew who my grandpa was. And it was really, really cool. And then, funnily enough, my dad must have been hot on my heels, and he sort of ran up behind me. And Don Bradman said, "Hey, Terry, how are you going?"
And
I really respected Bradman then for taking the time. Like, made me feel very, very good, you know. Whereas I've met a number of people, you know, at different times through my life who have said, "Oh yeah, I smashed the living daylights out of your dad. He never turned a ball, you know." And I never forget them.
No.
For different reasons, you know. I'll never forget what Bradman said to me about my grandpa. And then when he said hi to my dad, I sort of thought, you know, you're really cool.
Yeah, the one question I'd like to ask is, how did your granddad get Bradman out?
Yeah, so Bradman out Port Behind. I don't know exactly how, because I never actually asked Grandpa how, but he's in the Bradman Albums, which is cool. But he was caught behind off my grandpa's bowling, and he, you know, I think he made a massive 100 in the second innings. but anyway. But he got him once, and that's good enough for me.
When was the last time you cried, and why?
It's funny you should ask that, because I don't remember crying a lot when I was younger. I cry all the time now. But it's generally speaking when I see something that I think is, you know, happy, or nice things. And unfortunately, it can be, you know, I'll tell you honestly, the last time I cried was I was watching Yeah, this is interesting. I was watching, I really like the US Office, the US version of The Office.
Yes.
And I watched it, you know, I watched the episodes over and over and over again. And for some reason, the other day, I was just feeling like I wanted to watch Jim and Pam get married again.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah, I don't really know why, but, yeah, and I'm probably even tearing up thinking about it.
I cried during that, too.
It's just so stupid because, you know, I know what's going to happen. They're fictional characters, but I think it's sort of the fairy tale thing kind of makes me cry. And I'd like to believe in fairy tales, I think, and, you know, it was such a good, you know, and I got so invested in the characters and, you know, I really liked that show. And I'm not sure, I kind of like to watch it back to back to back just to see if I keep crying. But let's just say that at this point, you know, having seen it 5 or 6 times, it still makes me cry.
Me too, there's nothing wrong with that. Question 7, what is your current state of mind?
Currently, I'm really, really starting to get frustrated at not, I need to work out how I'm going to say this without sounding like a fucking loser. At the moment, if I'm being brutally honest, at the moment, I'm starting to get very frustrated at not having, something a little bit more concrete to go to, you know, employment wise. I spend a lot of time, coaching and helping out other people, both in, a cricketing sense, but also, in, you know, areas outside of cricket. So, you know, whether I'm helping somebody out with their business or you know, I've got a couple of friends who are, working in media, you know, help them out. But I'm not really committing a great deal of time to doing something I like doing on a daily basis. And I'm starting to get quite frustrated at that. I think it's long overdue for me to wake up in the morning and go to work, even if that's a really boring sort of menial 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 kind of proposition. I think I'm starting to get frustrated at that. So my state of mind is slightly uneasy. I think that's equivalently, I just start to feel a little bit uneasy. Yeah.
It's just a massive transition to make.
I think I've been making that massive transition for a long time. And the problem is, as I said to you before, I'm pretty good at just sort of going, well, I don't like that, I'm going to move on. And so a couple of times I've had some false starts, if you like, since I've been, because I've almost been 10 years out now. And I've had some great jobs in that time, some really great jobs. And I think I've actually been quite good at a couple of them. But I've just kind of gone, okay, well, that's not exactly what I want to do, so I'll just move on. Because I'd be able to do that quite easily because, you know, I'm focused and I've just had a little period of time here where I'm just not all that happy. You know, it could turn out that actually the thing that makes me happiest is working in a restaurant. And I'm not joking there. I may actually find myself happiest when I'm working in food and wine, but not in a very, very deep way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just, you know, I like being surrounded by people who are enjoying themselves. And I'm not talking about the nightclub at 3 o'clock in the morning, although, you know, I've enjoyed that from time to time. I'm talking about sitting there, I'm facilitating the you know, the enjoyment of food and wine.
Stuart was known for reading wine and food books on tour and studied wine marketing before hosting his award-winning TV series, Uncorked, for Foxtel.
I think one of the great things cricket's done for me during my life is it's given me the means to be able to, you know, follow my passions a little bit, you know, and I really like eating and drinking. I love sitting around a table, and it could go back to my grandpa in Florence and stuff like that. I love the European style of, you know, well, I love the European lifestyle. You know, yeah. The fact that they sort of sit around, eat, drink, talk, listen to music, and look at beautiful things. You know, I can't really think of anything better. You know, maybe I can't do that all the time, but I certainly like to surround myself with people who are. You know, I'm happy to help out and in any way I can. So, you know, you never know. I might find myself working, you know, in a little coffee shop in the back streets of Venice or something like that. When my kids were all grown up, you know, nobody would know who I am. I'll just be this crazy old guy smiling every time somebody enjoys their glass of wine.
And nobody will bother him about cricket, which is what I'm about to do now. Question 8. What is your greatest achievement?
Greatest achievement is a tough one. I mean, if you were into legacy, I think you probably would say your kid. Achievement is a very difficult thing to measure because it's all about the framework you put around it, right? I mean, yeah. I don't talk about my sporting achievements too much, to be honest. But I think, you know, historically, I know that I did, you know, well for myself on the cricket field, and I'm very proud of what I achieved on the cricket field. I know that I expected what. I set goals for myself in a cricketing sense that were pretty unrealistic, and kind of achieved them. I pretty much achieved them over the course of 10 years, which is pretty, you know, I'm very proud of that. I think I'm proud every time, you know, my daughter Penny gets out of a taxi and says thank you to the driver. Thank you. Have a nice day to the driver. I'm very proud of that, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, I've sat with sportsmen for years, you know, talking down to taxi drivers,
yeah,
and hated that. And so I quite like, you know, I am proud of raising children that are polite to other people. I guess that's one my you know, doffing of the cap to, you know, that standard on, you know, my crown and glory is my kid. Because one thing that I'm very aware of is the fact that I am basically just a sportsman. So I know that sport's got a place. I'm very, very pleased. I'm very proud of everything I've achieved in sport, particularly cricket, because I think it's a, you know, it's a pretty tough game. Mm. And I love the fact that I was good at cricket, but it's just a sport, and you know, my kids, which will probably be long after I'm gone, but my kids are, you know, it's unlikely that they'll be professional sportsmen and women. You know, I'm not saying that because they're no good at it, but they're great at sport. It's just they have other interests as well, and you know, percentage wise, it's highly likely that they'll be good at something else as well, which would make me very proud and possibly, you know, make a greater contribution to society by having them do something off a sporting field rather than on. And look, I know it's a real sort of, you know, cliche, so, you know, kids being your best achievement, but you know, that may well turn out to be the case. I mean, obviously, the fact that I was, an incredibly handsome and debonair sporting icon is something that I'm very proud of too.
That's right, mate. That's right. It's, I mean, it you were, you know, it was such an incredible period in Australian sport when we didn't have a leg spinner really since Bob Holland, and then two of you emerge at exactly the same time. And in many cases, whenever you and Warnie were together in a test, your performance was better, yet the attention turned towards him. Here are the stats. Warne and McGill played together in 16 tests, and McGill took 82 wickets at 22 in those matches, while Shane Warne took 74 wickets at 29. McGill took a wicket every 41 balls, while Warne struck every 56.
You know, I think he's a once in a generation. You know, biomechanically speaking, the guy's a freak. I mean, he had three career-ending injuries, but they didn't end his career. So, I mean, resilience and just the ability to continue on and to shape his game as his physical abilities change. So he was amazing. I think that the sad thing for all spin bowlers sort of subsequent to that is that they're going to be compared to him just as much as I was. It's just that I had the opportunity to bowl down the other end. they're on a hiding to nothing, whereas I was fortunate enough to have actually played with the guy. One of the very good reasons I'd suggest that my figures were quite flattering whenever I played with Shane, I was up the other end when he was bowling, and he was up the other end when I was bowling. So,
right,
who would you rather have up the other end, Shane Warne or Stuart McGill? Well, I'll say it's a pretty easy answer, and it's not me. That's probably, got a little bit to do with the figures. But the other thing that I also believe, is that I was very, very single-minded about what I was trying to achieve on the cricket field. And it wasn't to be as good as Shane Warne. It was if we're in a test match, there's 20 wickets that we need to take to win the test match. And my goal was to take as many of them as I possibly could.
Yep.
And failing that, to contribute as significantly as possible to taking those 20 wickets. And I think that single-minded sort of, point of view or, outlook meant that sometimes my stats were, inflated or amplified because, that was all I was focusing on. So it wasn't on, runs, or it wasn't on looking the best, or it wasn't on racking up consecutive test matches or becoming a part of the team. It was just every single time I got a chance to play, I wanted to contribute as strongly as I possibly could to those 20 wickets. And, that's what helped me out. The other thing is that maybe I was just really good at being the stuntman, being the 2IC. I know they tried a lot of spin bowlers. From the time I got picked for Australia to the time I finished, there were a lot of other spin bowlers played for Australia in various forms of the game apart from me. And they just kept coming back to me because maybe, I just did my job better. And my job was to put in whenever needed, if and when Warne was unavailable, or if and when they decided they needed a second spin bowler. And I knew what I had to do, and I liked doing it. And when you've got somebody like Shane Warne in the team, it makes you feel really good if you get more wickets than him, because you know how good he is. And that people invariably are going to compare you favourably. So I liked it a lot. I mean, I remember taking 7 wickets day one at the SCG event for the West Indies, and they were the first 7 wickets to fall. And, walking home, we went out for dinner in Paddington that night, and I remember feeling just really good.
Yeah.
Really good about myself. And Rachel and I, we had a nice meal, and I enjoyed the way it made me feel when I did well, and that was partly because I was playing in the same year as Shane Warne. You kind of couldn't win because he's the best of all time. So any wins that you did get, that made you feel even better. So I consider myself very lucky to have played at the same time as him. The final reality is this: if Shane Warne hadn't come along, I possibly wouldn't have played Test cricket. made sure that an attacking wrist spin bowler was a vital cog in the Australian cricket team.
Wow.
And so when he wasn't available, they were desperate to try and fill the hole. And you know, even when he was available, they were just looking for a backup in case there was a problem.
Yeah.
I've never been able to understand why they just pick the best 4 or 5 bowlers.
Yeah.
They pick a couple of left-handed quicks in a team. Why don't you pick a couple of right-arm legs in it?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense at all. And if you look at all the tests that we did play together, I can only think of off the top of my head 1 or 2 that we may have lost.
Yeah.
I'd say we've probably lost 2 in the left innings, one series, but Shane was injured. So, I just don't see that being valid. But I mean, when we were on, I mean, we almost finished the rest of the world concert because he and I, he just come off 40 wickets in the 05 Ashes, and I was, coming off the incredible disappointment of not being used in the 05 Ashes, and I think we got something like 15 wickets out of the 20 between us,
yeah.
And just completely wiped the rest of the world off the park. People just said, well, the rest of the world idea is stupid, they weren't trying. Trust me, man, they were trying, we just were on fire.
Yeah.
And in the other team, Miralitharan and Vittoria were in the other team, they couldn't get a wicket between them.
Yeah, there you go. I mean,
I just wish we'd played together a bit more, that's all.
That's right. And is there a shorthand that you guys have? Because you pretty much you're breathing rarefied air, the two of you, two wrist spinners, around the same era, both reach extraordinary heights in your chosen field. Is there stuff that you guys could talk about that you can't talk about with anyone else?
That's quite a good question. I dare say there are things that we could talk about, but we're very different people. We do speak probably a different language to one another, unfortunately. I would suggest that Shane's setup was a little bit different to mine. But one thing that we do have in common, we both were very self-assured on the field, but probably for different reasons as well. I was forcing myself to be that way. I think he probably just was. When bad things would happen around him, he was able to put him aside and move on. The sorts of bad things that would happen around me were very different. We probably didn't talk about. We probably don't talk about the sorts of things that you know. We probably don't communicate about spin bowling a great deal. His approach when he was bowling was to trap people on the crease. Mine was to get them to come out of the crease. I'd like to say that, we do have, an understanding, a level of understanding that is, outside the norm. But I think I'd probably be lying. The other thing is, I don't think Shane liked playing with me very much, to be honest. I think he's sort of been widely documented as saying that he preferred that I hadn't been playing at the same time as him. And so there is a little bit of that too. I mean, whereas I didn't really care who was up the other end, just so long as someone was there. It didn't really bother me. I don't think he liked me being in the team too much. which is a shame, because as I said, we didn't lose too often when we were both players.
Well, Warnie wasn't called Hollywood for nothing, and I've never met a superstar willing to share the spotlight. Apologies to any superstars listening to this podcast.
I was more than happy flying under the radar, being, you know, the stuntman, if you like, coming in and doing the tough bits every now and then.
Yeah.
And then sort of sliding out of frame again, whereas Shane liked to be, liked all of the bits and pieces around it, you know, I still don't, I'd much rather have a good time, you know, in a dark room.
yeah.
Rather than being in the spotlight.
Oh, that's a good line. The second last question, question 9. And my favourite question, who would you want on your side in a battle and why?
I'm going to be incredibly, incredibly conceited here. I would like me to be alongside me, which is an incredibly conceited response, I know.
I get that.
Yeah. Look, the reason for that is that I don't trust too many people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they're malicious. It's that at some point or another, you've got to look after yourself. I really do believe that. You know, if you had to choose between me and your family, if you didn't choose your family, there's something wrong with you. I'd certainly not think any less of somebody for, you know, putting personal ambitions or concerns ahead of my own, you know. I'm very comfortable with that. I don't, you know, as I said, I don't look down on anybody for that. So I completely trust myself. I also know that one of the other reasons that I trust myself is I'd hate to put somebody in the position where, you know, my life was on the line. I'd hate to put them in the position of having to have their my blood on their hands.
I really don't
like that idea. The huge responsibility of having to look after somebody else. You know, if I go down as a direct result of being inept or not being up to, I'd be comfortable with that. You know, you make your bed, you lie in it, that, all those sorts of things. I also know that, you know, if you give me a framework and you tell me, you know, what I've got to do and what I'm faced with, I can be particularly single-minded about it. Probably single-minded to the point of being obtuse, that's what you would probably require in a battle.
Yes.
I think it'd be just a hell of a lot easier, and I'd feel a lot more comfortable if I knew that there was somebody with the same sort of outlook as me standing next to me. If that person could also be incredibly gifted and coordinated, that would be very handy. so maybe not a direct mirror image of me in that case. Somebody that could handle themselves, because I'm not a fighter.
You started your first test. Mark Taylor was your captain, and your final test, I guess, it was Ponting. Who understood you best, and who was probably your favourite of the captains?
Okay, so. You know, with respect to Ricky, you know, I've got a choice of, you know, in terms of regular captains, I've got a choice of Ricky Ponting, Mark Taylor or Steve Waugh. So with respect to Ricky, we'll just leave him out of this conversation.
Okay.
But, Ricky was probably one of the favourite players I played with.
Yep.
Because he was very, very single-minded and determined. But in terms of favourite captains, the other two were certainly the grand finalists.
Yep.
when I first started playing Test cricket, Mark Taylor was the captain, and he was captain of New South Wales too, which is probably good for me, because he I knew him a little bit at least by the time I played. But he was great because he's sort of like a headmaster. He'd tell you what to do. He'd tell me what to do, and he would then, in a sort of headmasterly way, be alongside me, making sure I did it.
Yeah, okay.
He had a duty of care from his point of view, and he would concentrate on you doing what he'd asked you to do.
Yeah.
And it was quite flexible in terms of, like after my first test, for example, he and I flew back to New South Wales to play in the Shield game, but he said to me, listen, you only play your first test match once. Make sure you have a good time tonight. And, he certainly wasn't, super strict or anything like that.
Mm.
But he would just make sure that you did what you needed to do and didn't let yourself down. I remember when he retired, I was really, really upset because I thought, well, how am I going to play without him? I just didn't think that I was going to be able to keep going without him being the captain. Of course, the best way of going about things, which is why Steve Waugh is probably my favourite captain, is the best way of going about things is to make sure that people can operate without you.
Yeah.
And Stephen, that's what Steve did. He would build you up to the point where you felt that you could do things by yourself. He armed you with the tools you required to sort the issue out yourself. I remember him coming up to me in a test match. We're playing against South Africa at the SCG. He came up to me in the test match, and he's walking towards me, and I bowled probably four overs. Yeah, I bowled four overs, I'd say, at the time, and I've got none for 20. So I got five and over, roughly. My first test match in, a year or so, he just came up to me and said, oh, how are you going? And as he's walking towards me, I thought he's going to take me on. How are you going? Here you've been bowling, really well, for New South Wales, keep it going, eh? And just turned around and walked off. And that the matter was, he was telling me that he was going to take me off. And I knew that, and he knew that, and he knew I knew, and he also knew that I didn't want to get taken off. And I got, I think the next two overs, I got, two saves, were probably my favourite two wickets, against South Africa. Caught behind. So I was,
wow.
And it's because of what he didn't say. The other thing that I'll say about him is the first tour I ever went on was to India was in 1998, and in those days, you're still buying CDs and stuff in Hong Kong. Kids are so much cheaper than in Australia. And I liked music. That's an understatement. I love music. I love music. It's one of the only things that makes me really, truly happy nowadays, I guess, music. But I like all sorts of music, including pop music. I bought a whole bunch of CDs, and I got back in the team bus, and we're going back to the hotel at the end of the day, and Steve Waugh said to me, so what do you buy? And I went, no, I'm not. I said, don't worry about it, you're not, because I know he's into John Williams. That's probably a genre that I'm not necessarily into. I just don't worry about it. But, give it to me, Simon. But eventually he steals the bag off me, and he's going through it. He's got, Pet Shop Boys, Stand Out Ballet, Depeche Mode, Anyway, so he's going and he's kind of just flipping his ground going, you're a joke, what's this? Anyway, that's 1999. In about 2003, we toured South Africa, and when Stephen was captain, a couple of times each tour, he would go out for dinner and have a meal with every single person in the team.
Oh, so, wow.
And this
morning, he came down to breakfast and he chucked up the newspaper down on the table. So 2003, and he said to me, dude, Depeche Mode's playing in Joburg tonight, do you want to go?
So this
is like a guy from Panania. He's got nothing in common with me whatsoever. But I would do anything for him today. You know, like, he's an amazing man because he was a sponge. And to have remembered, and the only interaction we'd had on that level of music was in 1998.
And, wow.
You know, so 5 years later, he remembered. And we didn't end up going to concert, but, you know, I was just stunned that he would remember that. And that was, that's why he was a special kind of guy.
Yeah.
He knew what it took to make, he didn't necessarily understand what made me tick, but he knew what I needed.
Yeah.
And that was the big thing, and I think that's why he was a great captain.
As a spectator, you always have a bit of a cry when you're watching a Steve Waugh highlights reel, you know.
Oh yeah.
Just the steeliness and there's something very old fashioned about him too, and which I love.
I think the old fashioned aspect of it is that of all the players that I played with, you know, the level of respect he had for things that have gone before him.
Yeah.
Was very high, and I think with cricket that's very important because we are a very, it's a game that's very much, you know, a product of its history, and I, you know, even with the innovations surrounding, you know, T20 and stuff like that, you know, we're still wearing a baggy green and people are still talking about it, and you know, baggy green is just a hat, but it's not just a hat, it's a representation of, you know, of the achievements of every single person who's ever played before you, and you know, and he respected that, and I liked that.
Well, yeah, there's a lot more I'd like to ask you about that.
We'll save that for another time.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, as a cricket nerd, there's a lot to ask. And the final question.
I'm pretty easy to get at, Adam. All you need to do is bring a couple of bottles of wine, and I'll talk for as long as you want.
Mate, you can consider that a done deal.
Done. Ready.
The final question is, what would you like your last words to be?
You know, I really don't want my. I'm not ready for my last words.
Fair enough.
So you know, I'll come up with something for you, Adam, just for you this one time. But it's probably the first. I'm not ready to go yet. So, but look, I'd love to think that something along the lines of thank you very much. I've had an amazing time.
Yeah.
That would probably be great for me. And I'd love, you know, depending if there were anybody there with me, I'd like to sort of think that you could, you know, say something along the lines of and I'm sure you will too, you know.
Yeah.
Or just make sure you do too. You know, I'm very lucky. You know, I've had a pretty good time already, and you know, I always sort of joke that there's, you know, that it's not a question of whether or not I've ticked all the boxes. It's finding more boxes to tick.
Yeah, it's true.
And you know, hopefully I've found a lot more than I, because I you know, I've ticked most of them already. Maybe I need to do the search a bit harder. But I thanks, I've had a great time. And it's because of you guys. I think that's probably...
That's great.
It's largely because of the people who are in the room. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not ready to go yet, Adam, so we'll consider that one a work in progress, eh?
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2... All engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.